I cannot sleep. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Welcome to the show.
I was just thinking, I was like, if I were like a really cool person, how would I want my favorite podcast to start? And that's what I came up with.
The Blink 182 song?
Yeah. It's like really fucking cool and like really punk rock and like really cool.
I like where you're at.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Welcome to the manic episode.
Welcome to the shit show.
Welcome to another episode. This is season 2, episode 6. Yes, we have a guest on this podcast, but our guest is a fucking all-American badass. So we couldn't take up too much of her time.
Yeah.
We had to be gracious with her time. So we got in an interview. She's super busy. We talked to her. You'll hear it later. But for now, I think it's time to prevaricate.
Ooh.
It's time to engage in some mendacity.
Ooh, honey.
Is this thing on? Okay. You want to tell the first lie?
Yeah, I'll be mendacious. Mendacious.
Mendacioso.
Delicioso. Oh, shit.
What?
I meant,
please tell me.
I meant, oh crap.
Sorry. I farted.
Oh crap. Sorry. Oh crap. Brittany R just kicked my ass at craps. And now she's number one in the big craps game. Well, I'll see you at the World Craps Championships, my friend.
Championships. I'll see you at the craps. They don't call it the cramps, the craps championships. Then I don't care about life anymore.
That was my favorite. I think that was my favorite lie.
I think that's my favorite one you've ever done.
Oh shit! Because I forgot why I wrote. Oh crap!
Oh sit!
Oh,
what? Siri just released a line of furniture called Stay Dough. It's furniture made out of Play-Doh.
What is oh sit?
Like sit on the furniture?
Why?
Because you said, oh shit. I mean, oh crap.
It doesn't make sense, though.
Listen back to it. It really does make sense. And you're going to feel so weaselly and wienerly. Okay, what's your next lie?
Wienerly is my new favorite adverb. Oh my God, I love it.
Wait, okay. You nailed that part of speech, by the way.
Thank you. I love my parts of speech.
Hurry up.
Okay, oh my God. Well, I was at the store by myself without you, by the way. I was all by myself, just hobbling along, and one of my crutches got stuck near the carts. And Teddy and Jackson stopped what they were doing and gave me a hand. And help me with my crutch by the carts.
Oh, hold on.
What?
I can always give you a hand.
You're sleeping on the couch tonight.
Mary's glaring at me like so intensely. Where did your crutch get stuck?
By the carts. In
where?
The vent. In the vent. In the crate. In the crate.
Get in the crate. Not to be outdone by Siri, Sam and Mena just released a line of furniture made out of silly putty.
Oh.
It's called City Putty.
Oh my God. You said, oh, sit.
Oh, sit. Not to be outdone by Siri, Sam and Mena released a line.
Don't say it again. Oh my God.
I think we did really good. Hey, babe, do you want to kick it old school?
Yeah.
All right. Hollis Wongware.
What?
No, but seriously, we are so fortunate that someone as successful and like professional as accomplished as Hollis put up with our asses for as long as she did.
For real.
But I would love to tell you about Hollis.
Oh my God.
Do you know about Hollis?
Sit. Tell me about Hollis.
So listen to this shit.
Okay.
Hollis Wongware is a songwriter, musician, speaker, creative generator, and community advocate who lives between Los Angeles and Seattle. She is the lead vocalist of the electronic R&B trio The Flavor Blue and was Grammy nominated in 2014 for her work with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Have you heard of them?
Who?
A one?
Huh?
A two? With her roots in spoken word and slam poetry through the nationally recognized Youth Speaks program, Hollis is passionate about how creativity and the arts fuel and shape civic discourse and is dedicated to lending her voice and capacities toward vibrant social equity. Mm. Hollis has been a featured speaker at conferences, conventions, and speaker series, sharing her spoken word poetry and her candid insights on her experience as an independent artist and engaged activist. Mm. She has performed and spoken for an array of organizations and schools, including KEXP, Rap Women, Planned Parenthood, shout out, University of Washington, YWCA, and the Eileen Fisher Leadership Institute. She's been featured by TEDx University of Washington and has presented alongside such luminaries as Gloria Steinem, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Eve Ensler.
Woo!
Some serious luminaries. For my real. Goodness. A native of the Bay Area, Hollis graduated from Seattle University with a major in history and a minor in global African studies, and was recently named the recipient of Seattle University's 2016 Outstanding Recent Alumna Award. She is a Google Next Gen policy leader, an alumna of the Hedgebrook Residency, and is a Humanity in Action Senior Fellow. Hollis has been appointed to several boards and commissions, including the Board of Directors for For Culture and the Seattle Center Advisory Commission. And she is currently an ad hoc commissioner on the Seattle Music Commission. And Mary and I had a fucking blast talking to her. Let's listen now.
Let's go. Hi, Hollis.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being on our like totally organized, professional, seamless, well-produced. Together. Absolutely. I hope that you're not overwhelmed by our professionalism.
Timely, punctual.
No, you guys are beautiful just the way you are. And it's just wonderful to see your faces.
We're beautiful just as dysfunctional as we are.
No, as human.
As human. Embrace. Oh my gosh. Isn't this all about reframing and understanding and giving ourselves grace and forgiveness?
Say that.
Actually, yes.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's a good practice today.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. It is a good practice today because we are just like not operating on all cylinders, but we're going to let that go. I'm embracing this philosophy.
Yes.
And
yes.
We're moving on. And I might maybe have like sweaty pits from the technological snafus of the night. We're moving on.
Yeah.
I feel really good about it.
Yes, me too. Me too. We're here. And Hollis is here. I cannot believe you're here, Hollis, talking
with us.
I'm
here. Oh my gosh. But I have to answer the call. I'm such a fan of Wyatt and Mary. I've been avidly double tapping all of the engagement content. Congratulations on it all. You already know I text squeed you.
And Hollis is like an OG big time member of like the Mary Booster Club, right?
I think the founding member. Like,
really?
Yeah. I have been a fangirl from jump. I'm not an A&R, but like I do feel like I discovered Mary Lambert, even just for me. Not that you were there to be discovered, but I like you, the discovery of you in my life was a really profound one. And I'm just so thankful for our friendship. It's been a really long time, babe.
How did y'all come to discover each other? What was that process like?
I knew I was a good artist, but I really did feel like you did champion me. Like you were there, like almost immediately, like trying to get me gigs, and like we weren't really friends. Like you were a mentor. I knew you sort of like as an acquaintance, but you were not like we didn't like really hang out. You were just like. Like, I love what you do. I want to get you hooked up. Like, do you want to do this show? Do you want to do this? Do you want to work with this person? You know, it was just, and then we became really good friends.
Real quick.
We saw each other a lot.
I won't ever forget when, you know, so basically for those who don't know, Mary and I met through an organization called Youth Speak Seattle. And Mary was like a participant. She was a slam poetry contestant. And I was working with the organization. And I just really remember very vividly, there was a slam that we did that you featured at as the musical guest that I hosted at the Fremont Abbey downstairs. And you performed Body Love, I want to say. And I mean, teen poetry slams, youth poetry slams were definitely like my church, my spirituality, like the place in which I felt communion. Seeing you perform was like a really deeply moving and spiritual experience. Like I cried. I was like very, just really, really moved and touched by your work. And just there's something about a young artist in their teens, just like being brave as fuck. And that was you. And your voice was exquisite. And I was just like, yeah, let me just put this young, talented ass person on as much as possible. And it's been one of the great privileges of my life. And then we went on tour together and we were in a motherfucking Dodge Caravan, you, me, and three other big ass personalities for like months. And yes. We shared a bed. We shared a queen size bed with two other girls. And there was four of us in one hotel room every night. Nobody else's feet. I would have rather smelled.
I was just gonna say my feet are notoriously stinky.
I have not experienced that
in those ballet.
I think
flats.
That I am like nose blind.
It was the ballet flats, though. I'm assuming that you've stepped up, literally and figuratively, your foot game.
No, I still have all of those shoes.
I'm dead. I'm dead.
They're actually going to be wedding favors.
I'm bottling the scent.
It's going to be you're just going to squeeze the insoles.
I can't even smell, but I know it was like rancid.
So what tour was that? And who were the other women on the tour?
That was Macklemore's first like bar and club tour. Like it was right after, it was right during the heist. Like
it was like small theaters. It was right when the heist came out. The rooms were like 1500 to like, I think the biggest room was like 2500 cap, and it was completely sold out. I remember, I don't know, Mary, if you were in the band with us, but I really, really like, we were in Burlington, Vermont, which you fell in love with and would later return to because it was like Christmas town and Burlington, Vermont. And we were leaving the venue and we turned on the radio and Thrift Shop was on the radio and we were like, what? It was like this whole like moment. Little would we know how ubiquitous the artist would become, but at that time, it was just like, there's no way this is happening.
Who else was with y'all?
Natalie was playing cello, I think, right?
But she, remember, we were in the auxiliary van. So everybody was on the bus. And then the van was you, me, Wands, who sings Thrift Shop. And then the dancers, Anna and Keisha.
Yes. Oh, wait, did we room with Anna and Keisha?
Sure did.
Why don't I? I drank a lot that first tour too. I was like, tour, Liddy.
Yeah, it seems like Hollis. You seem like you're sort of the historian of you're like curating all of these records, all these artifacts, all these experiences.
I mean, I think that was important for me. Like that tour was really important for me, and I was like assistant tour managing too. So like, not to say that I was deeply responsible, but I just like logistically, like I literally was like filling up the air in the confetti cannon every night, like taking the confetti cannon in the van to the gas station. And like, I was booking hotels and because I had come from a tour management background and I was just happy to help. And that's kind of had been my relationship with that team, was like doing everything. And like, so I was kind of, and I think too, I was kind of just like, I'm not worthy just as a singer. Like I need to like do more to prove myself and like be evaluated. Wow. You know, that whole kind of like, let me like, you know, have awful boundaries, which are completely of my own design. and yeah, so it's just, yeah, it was a formative time, but it was a really beautiful time.
I've never known, like Hollis, when you first like started out, when you first were like, I want to do something in music. Like where was the gestation for you? Like, what was the initial direction?
Right. So I think for me, like it was a long time developing because I used to sing in choir and I did musical theater. And like, I think for a minute I was like, I want to be a musical theater, like actor. I want to be like a star on Broadway. And then I think I realized like, like coming up in like the early, like late 90s, early 2000s, there was no like Hamilton to speak of. Like there was, there was a Rent, you know, but there wasn't like, there was like just one Rent. And I was like, you know, only one Rent. And I was like, I guess I could be Maureen. But like, I just didn't see, I didn't see it for me. I just was like, I have a lisp. I read as Asian. I just am not seeing, and I wasn't like this prodigal musical theater talent. So like, I was just like, yeah, I was really discouraged. And I think in general, I had kind of like discouraged myself a lot from feeling like I was like commercially viable, whether that was like a confluence of like general feminism, like feminized social conditioning and like lack of Asian American representation and visibility in media and my own like self-defeating. There's a lot of things that have gone on. But anyway, all that said, when I got into poetry, it felt like the anti-commercial thing, right? It felt like really radical. It felt like kind of very defiant to this idea of like commercial success, like defiant from the idea of like entertainment. Like, I don't need to audition. I'm my own story. I write my own script. So it felt really like, and very like cathartic. And so, you know, I think for me, poetry was really where I found my like narrative voice. But I think for singing, I had always seen that as something that like, I honestly didn't like write. Like, I mean, you know, Mary, when you and I met, I was in a rap group with Maddie. We were Canary Sing, and rapping felt a way more comfortable to me than singing, because like rapping was like poetry on top of beats. I was confident as a poet with Maddie, with my partnership with Maddie, who really, she was who gave me the confidence and enabled me to like envision performing on stage as a musician. But even when I was like very comfortable and like writing on my own raps and performing, and we were like audacious in that way, it took like 5 years for me to even sing a hook on a Canary Sing song, let alone like, I had just told myself, if I wasn't a child prodigy and I wasn't like plucked for stardom or like signed to a record deal when I was 16, then like I didn't have it. You know what I mean? Just that very, very self-defeating narrative. Or like if I didn't like pick up a guitar, like if I wasn't like, you know what I mean? Just like these really, really outsized expectations of what it means to be talented. And also just like just this lack of narrative around like you have to be bad at something in order to be good at it. Like you have to... You have to humble yourself, you know, and I think I was afraid of that. So I really didn't start writing my own like singing music until I was like 24, probably, like probably 6 years into doing poetry and everything. And then, But I think, you know, I think for me too, it's like I was so into hip hop and so into rap, and in Seattle, like the community was so tight knit that like, the people that I like idolized, like I idolized Blue Scholars and like idolized like Gabriel Teodros and Kings as Abyssinian Creole. And like, I really was like a huge fan of Macklemore and like, wasn't, you know, like, and I was just so into this scene. And then because it was so porous and because I already kind of had a leg in between like You Speaks and then like being in the Hitmo community, I just wanted to be of utility and be like, just help out however I could. And it honestly worked. I mean, like, you know, me with Matt, like I wouldn't have been friends with Ben and Ryan if I hadn't produced a music video for them for free. And like, I wasn't expecting I'm going to be a featured vote like at all. Like there was, that was completely outside of the realm of possibility. I was just like, I just want to know them because I like their hustle and I like their music and I want to like be helpful and I want to like get in and learn. And then like, honestly, like, frankly, like Ben saw something in me as a vocalist that I didn't even see in myself. And he was like, at the time it felt a little insulting. He was kind of just like, yeah, your rap is cool, but like your singing voice. He had seen me do some dumb like Drake cover that I posted on YouTube. And he was like, yeah, like the rap is cool. Like that's cool. And like, I really think that you should like lean into the singing thing. And I was like, really? Like I had never heard any sort of affirmation on that. It's for my own music before. So it's interesting. It's interesting how it all falls together.
Wow. And you were tour managing for Blue Scholars at that time too, right?
Yeah. I was like co-managing them because they were independently managed at the time when I started working with them. So we did a whole album cycle together. Like we did a Kickstarter for their album and we did all these videos and I was like managing merch with Christine Geronimo. And it was just like, we did this whole like learning how to be an indie artist 101. And then as part of that, I tour managed for them on the road, which was like such a thrill. Like to be like, you know, they're still one of my favorite bands, but like to basically be working for your favorite band and getting to like settle and close out at the end of the night for them out of like a sold out Fillmore in San Francisco. Like I was like, this is the tightest thing ever. So
they, is that, that's a Seattle based rap group, Blues Ballers.
Yeah.
And they still perform.
They yeah, don't.
I think so, right?
No, they, nope. They're on indefinite hiatus. But okay. Gio of Blue Scholars owns Hood Famous Bake Shop with his wife, Shira.
So, yeah. Oh, awesome. That's a great name.
That's
right. It's bomb as fuck. Shout out the Ube Cheesecake.
So I met you through when you were doing You Speak Seattle. That's how we met through mm-hmm. writing and through poetry.
Correct.
Am I correct? Were you one of the founding members of You Speak Seattle?
No, so You Speak started in the Bay Area and I was a youth participant in You Speaks, and then Brave New Voices had already been built out. And so I had gone to Brave New Voices, which is the International Youth Poetry Slam. So I went to that was in the Bay my senior year of high school, and I met You Speak Seattle, the team, and I met like all these folks that would later become my close friends and my mentors. And I had been considering going to different colleges. I was actually potentially considering going to Wellesley. I was potentially considering going to Wesleyan. And I ended up deciding to go to Seattle U because I had gotten a full scholarship, which was like impossible to give up. Or like, but I may have not, and I may have chose somewhere else if I hadn't met the You Speak Seattle team, like in that formative time, and thought like, oh wow, this is a place where I could, like a city I could actually continue my passion for spoken word and find a community. And yeah, it really came to pass.
That really, I mean, this is going to sound like the most trite shit I've ever said, but I think that really speaks to the importance of organization of programs like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I feel like if the arts in general are like underfunded and underappreciated, then youth art programs are probably like doubly, quadruply, like hugely underfunded and underappreciated. Mm-hmm. Is that still, do you have any involvement now, Hollis, with any organizations like that? Or do you still kind of like just keep up with Youth Speaks from the periphery? And you're in LA now.
I am. Yeah. So I live in LA and it's interesting. So when, you know, I was a youth participant at Youth Speaks and then I became a teaching artist and I did the after school writing programs. And then I started like doing the event organizing for Youth Speaks. And I ended up being like the slam director and like running the slams for a couple of years. And then I kind of moved into like, management, tour management, just like all the kind of like indie artist things. But then I was also like sitting on a couple of boards for nonprofits. And so now the way that I'm connected is that I work more on the like arts administration side of things. So I'm doing less like program development and more like funding opportunities and grant program creation and facilitation for nonprofits. And like, I've been working City of Seattle Office of Arts and Culture for like recovery funding, like COVID relief recovery funding for arts and cultural nonprofits. So it's not as like a desire of mine, and I'm curious for y'all like how like in COVID times kind of community connectivity has felt for y'all. But I know that that's like an intention that I have for this upcoming year, is like, how can I better connect with my community in like really intentional, creative ways? Because I'm thankful to do the work that I do now, which is just like an important supplemental source of income for me, frankly, as a working artist. Like I need to be doing other stuff in order for me to live a comfortable life. But I also like want to make sure that I'm as like directly connected as possible, even despite Zoom and despite me like not necessarily like living in Seattle anymore.
Right.
I know, Mary, you've been doing the Everybody is a Babe workshops, and this podcast is a public service and a way to connect with folks directly, which is beautiful.
I really appreciate you saying that.
It's really nice.
I feel like I think my timeline is a little bit off, but I think we started the podcast like the November before the pandemic started.
December.
Right.
It was the December before everything.
And I think I initially was concerned that it seemed like podcast sort of like interest and listenership dropped precipitously because people weren't like driving to work and shit, you know? Mm. And I think a lot of people do like listen to podcasts while they're at work and things like that. So, but then I realized like our prime demographic is like people with mental illness who, you know, like experience like depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder and everything else. So yeah. So it turned out like, yeah, people want to have these conversations mm-hmm. And this is an important thing to do right now. And it's like, but it's a scary prospect, I think, as we sort of like stare down the possibility of, you know, going into lockdown again or whatever that might look like, you know, like how we're all going to adapt to those kind of, to that kind of isolation again, you know? But yeah, I know that you, Mary, have talked a lot about like kind of feeling a little bit like you're lacking that same sense of like local community that you had.
Yeah. I you talking about community and seeking that Hollis really resonates with me. Like, I feel like I have, it is really like I feel like making music and making art is a really insular experience that I think is important. I think it's really important. I feel like you have to get to your, like, you know, your truest self. You find your truest self, I think, when you make art and you create and you have to consult with, like, I don't know, you have to consult with your like deep self. And then I think the aspect of sharing, like the second part to being an active creator or artist, is like that invitation of sharing. But like there is something that starts to feel a little bit hollow about the process of that independent insular creation. And then the sharing almost feels like more of a broadcast. And so you're not really able to connect with people in any of that, really, unless you tour. And even that is still like, there's a real barrier between like how people are, you know, there's a real boundary of how people connect with you.
Yeah.
Like, and I think for safety sometimes, but I think also there's something that lacks, like, there's no reason for me to have at some point, you know, this in the last 2 years to feel like, do I need to be making music? Does it matter? And I know that my work is important, but if you don't have that connection or you don't invite that, you miss out a little bit, I think.
Yeah. I completely hear you. And Wyatt, I don't want to cut you off if there's anything that you want to add.
No, please. Yeah, no, go ahead, please.
I think like what I'm reflecting on, and there's a few things that are bouncing in my head as you say those things, Mary. I think that's the beauty that we didn't even know that we had when we were part of You Speak Seattle, which was like, I mean, SLAM itself is kind of problematic in terms of like the competitionizing of youth voice. Problematic in that framework, but this idea of like coming together in writing circles every week, having consistent community that's not actually based on the productivizing of our art, but really on the creation of our art. As a youth participant, you're just kind of like, oh, like this is what we do, and we come together as community. And I think as we get older and we become more professional in our artistic pursuits, there's this formalization, and let alone its interaction with capitalism and how that impacts our relationship to our art. But I totally hear you, Mary. It's like, I think especially with social media and that being the primary arbiter and connective tissue between ourselves and our audience, and that being itself really fraught, inherently capitalistic, inherently like objectifying, like self-objectifying. And there's such a lack of like ownership and authentic connection within it. Like, I know, and I'd love to kind of hear too, like, just, I think I got really discouraged during the pandemic thinking about like, am I really only creating for Spotify streams and Instagram posts? Like, is that really what this career is that I chose? Like, cause that doesn't inspire me. That doesn't light me up on the inside. Like, the thing that lights me up on the inside is when I'm with community, like those precious moments now that I you know, savor so, the memory of so deeply, of us being in writing circles or us being at venues where like the only way to come support somebody was to literally be there, like to show up, you know. And it's not a double tap, and it's not a, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a genuine engagement, and it feels sometimes very, yeah, just like deeply fucking depressing, frankly, to think about how our art that saved us, right? Like, saved us, gave us identity, gave us meaning, Where does that show up now? How do we show up now? And add a pandemic on top of that shit.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's like deeply fulfilling and satisfying to try to like, you know, appeal to Instagram's algorithm enough for your post to get attention or whatever the hell that process is like.
Totally. I saw this post by, do you know, I think their name is John Allison Weiss. Like, John made this post that was like, it was like this reel, and it was like clear that John was like not enjoying doing the reel. It was like, apparently this is how I share my music now. Is this good enough engagement? And I was like, oh my God, this is it. This feels like what it's being sort of reduced to, that you have to be
reductive.
You have to be willing to play the game. And like, it can feel, it can feel a bit like you're just running into, like you open a beautiful window and you see a concrete wall. Like there's, you know,
it seems too like I'm inserting myself into a conversation, obviously, that y'all know like way, way, way more about, but like from an outside perspective, it's like, I think there's been some kind of like equalizing between like people who are like indie artists and people who are on major labels, like in terms of social media being like an equalizer. But also I think like, it just from my perspective, it seems like there's always been with like big major label artists, like obviously there's ways to quantify their success in terms of like album sales or like the Billboard charts and like all that shit. But like now it seems like everybody has the same barometer for like how much attention you're getting or how much people like you or like how many followers you have. Like, I just wonder if that's something that like, it doesn't seem to me from the outside, like, that's necessarily a healthy thing, like that, because like just the numbers of people you're reaching doesn't really tell you much. Like, speaking of our podcast during the pandemic, like we sort of like reached a peak of followers and have sort of settled into like a certain number of people who listen. And but I keep thinking, I'm like, if that's the core audience, like if those are the people who like really need this and who really relate to it and feel like it enhances their life in some way, like that's fucking great.
Yeah,
amazing. I'm sure maybe like put blood, sweat, and tears into it.
Yeah.
Maybe we could like pump that up and reach more people. But yeah, I'm sure that like in so many ways, older artists probably envy y'all for like how you are able to create and put things into the world now. Mm. But then I'm sure there's some stuff that people are like, oh God, shit, I'm so glad I don't have to deal with social media. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I guess you really have to choose. Like, what do you value? You know, and I think you bring up an interesting point about growth, because I think and Hollis, I think you mentioned this too, that sort of the mechanism of capitalism being infused with art is that like there is a substantial amount of discouragement that you feel if you're not growing. And what growing means in like socially is that like you have more people that follow you. You don't know, like you can't quantify someone else's like enjoyment of your work. You know, it's like very difficult to do that. The only metric you really have is like social, you know, social exchanges, like that, social media exchanges.
Right.
But like, it's really difficult to hold onto something that's tangible and to not be discouraged about, like, you know, maybe it's okay that it stays here. Like it's here for the people that need it and want it. And maybe people cycle through, but it's okay if it doesn't have 200% growth every year, you know, like,
right.
I feel like that's where people really get in trouble, because they start feeling like, oh, I'm not growing. I'm not doing the thing I'm supposed to do. It doesn't have that. It's,
right. And that's a very like capitalist expectation of self. Like, I think one thing that I've really been reflecting on over the last couple of years is like the danger of expecting like scale at any cost, and the idea that scale equates with greater impact. Cause I don't think that's true. Like, I think that that's something that, first of all, like, we have to remember that these platforms, like, I think everybody's like, fuck Facebook, but we're basically still on Facebook when we're on Instagram, right? Like, these platforms, the platforms where we're like a third party is like holding our audience, it's where you don't actually have a true one-to-one connection with our audience. Like y'all doing the podcast, the Patreon, your Teachable, Everybody is a Babe workshop. These are actually like defiant ways of growing your own community. Yes, in digital and virtual spaces, but they're not interfaced by like a gigantic corporation whose goal is for us to waste our motherfucking time, take all of our attention, make us feel fucking bad about ourselves because they want to sell us shit on the platform. Like these platforms are inherently built for us to not be well, right? It's inherently cultures of like a platform of unwellness, of sickness.
Right.
There is new beauty that can happen. Like Mary, I've seen like the dope ass like amplification that has happened when you like shared your experience about going to an MRI and it really resonated with people. And like, I genuinely believe it's going to cause like structural change by people like having your experiences broadcasted. And there is like definitely merit in amplification and discovery, and just recognizing fundamentally these platforms foster and perpetuate and cultivate unwellness, period. So
yeah,
your podcast, your Patreon, your classes, you're actually building alternatives of places that actually can be healing and connective and be one-to-one. And you don't have to game a motherfucking algorithm, which is so embarrassing and condescending to our brilliance and our capabilities that we're really stuck here trying to figure out what a fucking algorithm thinks. And I'm waiting until fucking 5 p.m. PST to be able to post something because it's going to do better. Who cares? See, the thing about scale is like, so as you guys know, I'm a really big like student of the thinker and philosopher Grace Lee Boggs, who is like this really visionary Asian American organizer. And she puts this quote in her book, The New American Revolution. It's really powerful. And it's about how like, basically, like, I don't know shit about quantum physics or theory, but the idea that like, just that something can have tremendous global impact, even if it's like really small and contained, because it's actually like the depth of the thing that matters. And that's what can like siphon off an impact. It doesn't have to always be about scale and growth.
And it's so true. I was thinking, I really wanted to talk to you about your work with copyright, because I know that is something that is like in your wheelhouse, and like specifically with music, like, and copyright, like what do it do? What do it do?
I'm not like super qualified to break down like the nuts and bolts of like what copyright does, but I have been working with an organization called Take Creative Control for a number of years. And the founder of that initiative, Kim Tignor, she's a lawyer. And she and I actually sat in on the same talk by this professor named Professor Latif Matima. He's the founder of the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice. And he really made a case that like intellectual property ownership was an issue of civil rights, particularly like stemming from, you know, he's a Black lawyer professor from Howard University Law School, talking about how like African-American community and creators have been like systemically dispossessed of their IP rights and ownership. And, you know, especially like in music, like royalties and profits stemming from that for generations. And so Kim and I, we didn't know each other at all. We were strangers. But in that lecture that we both sat in, we both had a lightning rod moment. And for me, I was like, I have never really thought about myself as a copyright creator. Like, I've always just thought I'm a songwriter, like writing my little songs. Like, it's never been something that I've focused on. And what does it mean? And what does my ownership mean? And then Kim was sitting in the audience as a lawyer, as a civil rights lawyer, thinking about, oh, how can I incorporate like IP ownership and like the ownership of creators of color into my portfolio as a civil rights lawyer? And so she became so passionate about it that she actually left. And now she's the executive director of the Institute for Intellectual Property and Social Justice. And her and I collaborate together to create profiles about creators of color navigating the digital economy. And so it's been really cool because during COVID, I've actually just like gotten really into like more like documentary filmmaking and profiling artists of different disciplines about how they interact with the digital space. It's been really eye-opening. Like the last one that we did was about DJs who were trying to stream during the pandemic and were constantly getting kicked off Instagram and getting shadow banned. And even though it's like, again, Instagram, encouraging us to build our audiences on their platform. But then when we do a usage that is they don't like, we get penalized and sometimes even like banned from their platform. And all of that audience building is for naught. So I'm really interested in it as somebody who advocates for like creators' rights, and I'm learning more about like what it looks like. But I think ultimately with copyright, just creators really need to recognize that like we have power. I think you know this more than anybody, like Mary, like we are so conditioned to thinking that opportunities are given to us when really like we are the opportunity. We are the creators, and what we do, there's no industry without what we do as creators. So it's really kind of like pivoting and flipping the framework of how we're told that gatekeepers hold all the opportunities. It's like, well, we're actually the opportunity to cultivate. And so it's been a good paradigm, and it's a great organization. If you check us out, follow us on Instagram, ha ha ha, take creative control. And you can see the profiles that we've been working on.
God, isn't that so true? I noticed when I was on Capitol, I think there's this like there is this energy around artists that they don't know what's good for them, and they shouldn't advocate for themselves because it gets in the way of the business. And I think that's like really like disheartening and really difficult to understand that there's some psychological manipulation shit that goes to like keep artists from knowing their power and their value. And I think it's just like endemic of like how capitalism is like, you know, that the structure,
the driving sort of creative force.
Yeah,
totally. We bring so much value.
For real. Okay, Hollis, I want to tell you about your value.
So we are doing a new segment with Hollis. We might reserve this just for Hollis.
Yeah, this is just a Hollis-only segment.
Yeah, this might be a Hollis exclusive, but this is a compliment off.
Compliment competition, baby.
Yes, our goal is to either make Hollis cry or make Hollis really happy. We want her to be like, stop, please, just stop being so nice.
I love you so much.
I don't think I can take it.
I should protest if.
Yes, if we are doing our jobs correctly, you absolutely should.
Yes.
So I'm going to start, and I want everybody here to acknowledge that Mary actually is operating from a huge advantage because she has known you for a really long time and she knows you a lot better than I do. Mm-hmm. But I do think that also means that I am able to be objective about Hollis in a way that Mary simply cannot. So I just want to say that and I know that Mary has the voice of an angel, the voice of an angel from the lips of an angel, as one of my favorite songs says. So I know she has a lot of credibility, but I have more credibility. And so I just want to say, Hollis, you are okay. You have the vocabulary second only to myself.
Spicy.
Every thought that emerges from your head, just like Athena springing from the skull of Zeus, you know, fully formed and outfitted in warrior clothing. You're in our podcast intro. Like, you are a theme song. You are our theme song, Mary Lambert featuring Hollis. You are just such a cool, like intimidatingly cool person. And so your coolness is actually like the least interesting thing about you. And that's really cool. And
Time.
Okay. All right. That's my time. Okay. Well, that was just a total fucking mess.
Wow. It really came together there at the end, Wyatt.
It really didn't, but I really appreciate you being so generous. That's very nice of you.
Stop complimenting.
No, I can't. I can never stop complimenting.
My turn.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Hollis, I think you are one of the people, like one of the best people in the world. And I think that honestly, you are one of those people that are just so in tune with what is good for the world. I think you have a deep wisdom. Like, I see you as like a very wise person. And I think you create these ripples of change wherever you go. And that effect, like, it affects how other people see the world. Like, you have changed my life because of that. You also like are so intuitive and read people so well, and you like understand how to facilitate like connection with the, with like other people. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you do that? You're like a wizard. You're like a wise, hot wizard and and an angel, and with the voice of an angel.
Okay. That's plagiarism. And, like, I just said that. And well, Hinder said that.
And your commitment to your, also like your commitment to creation and your art is inspiring. Like you make time to write. And I've never heard of that before. Well, no, I've heard of that before. But like you do writing circles. Like, you actively like really put your all into your craft. And I just think it's really beautiful. And I love you so much, and I know this time.
Honey, I'm actually impressed. Nicely done.
I love you. I love you both so much, and I love your love, and I love you guys together, and I love, like, your joy and your tenderness with each other.
Sounds like somebody is trying to participate in the competition, huh?
Don't do it.
I know. I'm like, do I get to compete, too? Don't try. Don't do it.
Okay. No ties, and you have to choose.
Yeah, no ties allowed. Who won?
Here's what I'm just going to say is, both of you said like really stunningly beautiful things, and I'm just so appreciative for both of you in my life and both of you together. I think the fact, Mary, that you called me a wise, hot wizard is probably the most outrageous compliment I've ever received in my entire life. And so I think for that phrasing alone, I'm going to give it to you, Mary Lambert.
Yes, I knew it.
I honestly, I can't compete with, like, I can't compete with wise hot wizard. That's just not something I can do. So I defer.
You really threw in hot, and I could tell that it was improvised and also inspired. And it made me feel really good about myself.
Well, you absolutely deserve to feel good about yourself mm-hmm. today and always. Mm-hmm. And we are just so fucking grateful that you joined us for this hot mess of a podcast. We are just so blessed to be graced with you.
Yes. Thank you.
And we just want to tell everybody who listens to this podcast, like, if you haven't listened to Hollis's music already, you are seriously missing out. Anybody who is a fan of us, is a fan of Mary's, will mm-hmm. be a fan of Hollis.
It's so true.
And she is just on another level right now.
I mean, the things you're making right now, Hollis, are like next level, and you've always made it incredible shit, but like your most recent single has just been on like re-fucking-peat. It's so good.
It really is. It's just absolute. You're just like at the top of your game, and it's just such an honor to have you here, and we hope that everybody, y'all, you yes. have to just like get on all of your socials.
Get on your socials.
On your social medias and follow Hollis Wongware. Otherwise, you are a big dingleberry and I hate you. And I hope something awful happens
yes.
to you.
I really appreciate it. And I think it's easy to feel discouraged in the grand scheme of things. And ultimately, like, I just, you guys seeing me, like, is all the like motivation, like, and encouragement I need. And so it means a lot. I hope you know that.
If it seemed like that interview ended abruptly, it's because my fucking computer died abruptly. And I don't mean the battery died. I mean the whole thing just shit the bed all over the coffee table. So I had to replace my computer. But Hollis is such a fucking gem.
Yes. And we did say goodbye to her and that we love her.
Yeah, we didn't just hang up on her. We're like, thanks a lot. Click.
Also, if you subscribe to the Patreon, we're going to have two videos. One is of the small video that we did during the interview. You'll be able to see the reaction of when the computer completely died.
Oh, you have to watch it. Like, also, this, like, tonight, our video, like the intro video, is like maybe one of the better ones we've done.
One of the best.
I mean, and by best, I mean, like, I mean the opposite of that, but like it's noteworthy in how bad it is. And I think you should watch it. I would pay for it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about our obsessions.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about our obsessions? I thought that we could do this in the podcast because, you know, like obsessiveness is sort of
a
symptom of mania.
Are you breaking down the podcast?
Yeah. Break it down, biatch. So my first obsession is I just today got done reading this tome of a novel by Honoré Fanon Jeffers. I hope that I am not mispronouncing her name. But it's this new-ish novel called The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. And it was out of this world. It was like maybe about 150 pages too long. And I'm not trying to be funny. Like, I really do think there was like a little bit of like there was a lot of exposition where I felt like maybe it wasn't needed. But like it is such a well, listen to me. Like, why am I nitpicking this fucking book? It was too long, but I thought it was really, really magnificent. So if you have lots of time to like really sink into and just enjoy and savor a really beautifully arranged novel that sort of mixes like the idea of, I'm going to say, like family lineage and heritage and background as it sort of applies to like the Black experience in this country and the sort of like difficulty of trudging through all of the like intentional erasure of family history. And, you know, it's just such a fascinating, like sort of like part historical fiction, part like contemporary, like coming of age story of this young girl growing up in like rural Georgia, who is kind of trying to make sense of her own family as it exists right now. And her family's sort of origin stories in the transatlantic slave trade and in the, you know, like tied into the experience of like indigenous people in this country. And it's just like a really generous, like really big hearted, just like rich novel. That's how I describe it. It's like a big ass slice of chocolate cake that's maybe like bigger than you really need it to be in order to enjoy it. You know what I mean? But you still want to eat it. It's just afterwards you're like, fuck, that was a really big piece of cake. You know, you're like, it was good, but like there's diminishing marginal returns.
Yeah.
That's my first obsession.
Okay. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You really seem to enjoy it. You read me some passages from it that I enjoyed too.
Yeah. It was really, really good. It was really good. It reminded me a little bit of, if anybody else has read The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, will you please tell me if, like, in some bizarre way you kept thinking of the Gilmore Girls in a way that makes absolutely no sense? Like, I just need to know that.
I like it.
And what are you obsessed with, honey?
Well, I, you know, I'm trying to get back on my sleep train.
back on your sleep bullshit.
I'm back on, trying to get back on to sleeping. I don't know. Like, I get obsessed with staying awake for no reason. Like, don't need to do that.
Another symptom of bipolar disorder.
Yes.
Something that we're just going to have to deal with all our lives.
Yes. So,
but you're just nocturnal. Like, naturally.
I'm between my sister and my mom and I would just like really like, if honestly, if the rest of the world would socialize that way, I would actually be nocturnal. Like, I really do think that it's like my natural state to be like very active around like 1 or 2 in the morning.
I think it's rad. Who cares?
So I have to really train my brain to be responsible. But that said, I have not. So like the last like couple days, I've been trying to oscillate between like getting rest and just having a hard time.
You're also healing, honey.
Yeah.
Like from a major injury.
Right.
We've both been obsessed with researching.
Yes, it's true. So that is kind of the obsession. So I realized, I was like, you know what? I know I tore my MCL, but like what does that mean? Like I wanted to know all the ligaments and I wanted to just learn about the leg. So I found this YouTube channel. And he's a doctor. His name is Dr. Nabil A. Ibrahim. And he is the professor and chairman of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Toledo.
Okay.
And he it just is.
Holy Toledo.
Sorry. Holy Toledo. There's anatomy. So I'm he has just a whole bunch of videos and he explains things really well, but I think it is for students. I don't know. He has a lot of subscribers though, so I think it's possible that it's a public YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
I mean, I feel like that's the democratizing effect of the internet.
It's amazing.
Like making stuff like this accessible outside of the ivory tower.
Yes.
Right? Like
yes.
This is what we want. We want public domain. We want scholarship to be in the public domain.
Yes. Love it. So I just really like the way he breaks things down. His videos are cool and they're like slides, you know, it's not, he's not like lecturing or anything, but
he has a great voice too.
Yes, he does. And, so I just learned all about the knee. I know so much about the knee and the leg and the ligaments and
it's so
the meniscus and the, you know, and the whole inner workings. I get it.
We were talking about how I was like, oh, I guess the knee is like a lot more complicated joint than the elbow. Mm-hmm. And you pointed out it's because of the fucking like floating ass kneecap
mm-hmm.
that is conjoined there. And like we have kneecaps so that we can pray.
You were like waiting for my reaction.
I'm sorry.
But he has probably, I think there's like, oh, like over 200, 300 videos of just
wow,
like, of like,
really? From him?
Yeah. Of just like
damn,
anatomy
cool.
stuff and orthopedic stuff. So I'm
he's
just
prolific as hell.
Yeah. So I've been that's all I've been doing is staying up until 5 a.m. for no reason watching those videos.
Well, I have a parallel obsession, which is I have been watching medical malpractice lawsuit depositions on YouTube.
That has been your obsession, yes.
And I have watched about, I'd say probably 9.5 hours of depositions related to this one medical malpractice case. I don't know why this law firm posted all these depositions. Maybe it's just because people are like enjoying them, mm-hmm. but it's like me and about 2,000 other people who have just like fallen into the rabbit hole of this case. And it's just like, I mean, growing up, my dad being, you know, a defense attorney, he was involved in stuff like this all the time, like mm-hmm. medical malpractice cases, incidents, accidents, like his defending insurance companies, but he would have to like depose doctors and, you know, nurses and people like this all the time. But like at the time, I didn't know how juicy this shit was. Otherwise, I would have been way more interested in it. Cause like the only exposure to his depositions I had before is when I wanted to tape something off of the TV, I would go to my dad's collection of depositions and like old deposition VHS tapes and mm-hmm. tape over them. Mm-hmm. So all of my favorite shows that I taped off the TV would be like, the episode would end and then it would be like 2 disjointed minutes of somebody being deposed and then a new episode would start. But these depositions, so this case is just about this one guy who went to the hospital several times complaining of his knee was swollen and he had terrible pain in it. And he was kind of sent home every time without getting proper medical care. Mm. And it turned out he had this like vascular condition and he ended up dying. Mm. And so there's depositions of like a physician's assistant and a triage nurse and the trauma nurse and a doctor. And it's just so fascinating to listen to, like not only from like the legal procedural sort of point of view, but I've also learned so much about the knee because this guy's injury was in his knee. Everything that was happening was the knee. So like this has been a very knee centric household.
It's so true.
And I think it's really cool.
I love that you're on that same sort of track.
You do.
Like that was like my favorite thing the other day where I was like, oh, I learned all about this. And you're like, I learned all about this.
We were like just without even knowing it.
We were on the same obsession.
I was walking through the woods with the dogs. Like I've been going on about like hiking about 2.5 miles with the dogs almost every day.
Yeah.
And I've loved it. And it's been like my medical malpractice lawsuit time. I just listen to it. It's worth it to me. Like paying for YouTube Premium, I have to say, is like one of my favorite investments every month because I can just listen to this weird shit and close my phone and the audio keeps playing.
Oh, man.
It's all the entertainment I need. And there's so many depositions about so many different subjects.
I'm happy you're happy.
Thank you, honey. And what is your next obsession?
Well, I'm just about to start the third cycle of my workshop. So I'm in that sort of headspace and I have so much on my plate right now. And I am trying to juggle a lot. But yesterday this idea popped in my head of the way I want to frame this argument about, you know, how dangerous, you know, the prescription of intentional weight loss is, and that, you know, and the difference between pursuing like sort of healthy behaviors or like, you know, changes to behavior as like for the sake of feeling good, not for the sake of a number on a scale.
Right.
And like that pursuit is like just much more sustainable if it's motivated by a desire to feel better.
Right.
And the problem with that is that you can't really quantify that. And so anyway, so that was the sort of the bulk of my argument. Anyway, the thing I'm obsessed with was making the post.
Right.
It just took me so long to like say it exactly the way I wanted to. And I got really like super obsessed with it. So yesterday I spent probably like 3 hours crafting the argument and writing and tweaking. And that was off of like 2 or 3 hours of like a previous insomnia night writing it. And then today I spent about 6 hours like formatting it, figuring out how I wanted to post it. And it is difficult when you work so hard at something and you're still misunderstood.
Right.
Like you say something as clear as you fucking possibly can. And then you get comments that are like the one of the comments I got was like, but I'm really glad I had intentional weight loss because I changed my behavior. So
oh,
I was like,
my God.
Oh my God, I'm literally gonna kill myself.
You're like, oh my God, Jesus. You're like willfully misunderstanding me. Like,
Jesus Christ.
Not willfully, but like, yeah. Oh my God, when you put that kind of care into
It's just rough. But I mean, also
it's like when I'm like, why do I make a syllabus?
Yeah.
Why do I bother doing this?
It's
but
it's also like, I know like people don't owe me anything for posting anything. Like it's just something I'm sort of broadcasting and it's like, I can't control how people view it. So it's a good practice and like, you know, letting like a sandcastle.
But I mean, people value what you say and people interact with you and respond to what you say. I mean, like, if people are going to respond with criticism and, you know, I think the overwhelming majority of like the response to your story about getting an MRI were positive.
Yeah.
And supportive.
Supportive, yeah.
But, you know, if those few people are going to respond to you with criticism or critique or anger or hate or whatever, like clearly there you are right to expect a measured response to like clarifying your ideas. And so I think it's totally justifiable that you're like, what the fuck? I spent all this time saying this and like I'm still not it's not broadcasting correctly.
Totally.
I thought it was really beautifully done. And maybe this will encourage some people who are listening to this to go and read it and like interact with it and respond to it and talk
you,
about
honey.
It, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not all for naught, you know, just because it might feel ineffectual now. It wasn't, you know, and you are going to incorporate that into the much bigger kind of project of your life right now.
Yeah.
What you want to put your energy into.
Yeah. Thank you, honey.
I'm glad I could fix that for you.
Oh, and I don't know. Let's see. I think this is going to come out before our next episode. So there's still time to sign up for the workshop.
Oh, yes. Right. What's the deadline?
January 30th.
Okay. January 30th.
And yeah, spots are still open. So
yeah, everybody.
People are welcome too.
Everybody's a babe. Everybody can go sign up. There are spots available. Are there scholarships available?
Scholarships are available right now.
And you should go apply. If you need it.
Yeah.
If you don't, sign up.
Yeah.
What the hell? Okay. My last obsession is fucking Amy Schneider.
Yes.
So I am so grateful that my sister, while Mary was out of town at the figure skating national championship, I went to my sister's house and they watch Jeopardy every night. And so they just put it on like, you know, at 7:30 or whenever it comes on. And I was like, oh shit, I haven't watched Jeopardy since my episode. Like I can't explain it. It's like, I don't know if I'd feel differently if I had like won an episode. I don't know, but there's this real frustration. Like the questions that you get wrong, like haunt your dreams. And it's just such an emotional high that there's something like really like, and I guess I'm not the only person to experience this. I really resisted watching it again.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I started watching again because Amy Schneider is like just the, I think today was what her like 38th win. And she's won like $1.1 million. It is just such a thrill to watch her compete. And I'm obsessed with her. I love her. I think she's such a badass.
I completely agree. It has been such rules. A fucking joy to watch her.
Also, Wordle is really fun. I hate
that was one of my obsessions too. Yes,
I need to do today's word. I haven't done it yet.
I love Wordle.
It's really like for once the mass. Every once in a while, the masses get it right. You know,
yeah.
Like the broken clock is right twice a day. You know,
there was a queer version of it that popped up on my social media.
Yeah, but one of the words was hole pick.
Yes.
No, so I
was like, that is we're not doing that.
No, we're not.
I was like, there is, you know what, like gay men culture is just so, sometimes different. It's just so different than like queer AFAB culture.
You know what? Actually, though, would you ever send me a whole pic?
Jesus Christ. Oh, my God.
Do you want to read your poem? Do you?
yeah.
Sorry. Okay. We'd love to hear it.
Okay, where did I find this? I can't remember where I saw this. I think this is from...
Well, that's not usually, like, we don't need to know the provenance of the poem.
I'm going to give my... This is my exhibition. Exposition. This is my turn.
This is my fight song.
This is my fight song. Okay, so this is... Well, because this is a poet who is 11 years old. So this is a poet, I think. Fuck it. This poem is called Ask Like a Wasp, After Principles by Adina Smith, by Aya Al-Zubaydi, age 11.
Cool.
Ask if safety is near. Ask if violence is off limits. Ask if violence is the answer. Ask if someone who didn't do anything wrong can be hurt. Ask if promoting respect is wrong. Ask these questions and think. Ask not like a bee who stings and dies, but like a wasp who stings and stays alive. Mm. I don't want violence anymore. I want a good president. I want good laws and actions. I want a sprinkle of gold on a butterfly's wing, stating all violence is gone. I want safety for all people like a cool wind. We will feel like a bird that flies in the air swiftly. Safety and violence are different, but we need safety. I look in eyes and see terror. I imagine the fear is gone and the morning light is left. Let's not sit and stare at violence like it's a balloon being blown forever. Let us not make ourselves fail because of violence. Mm. Let us fight for safety, fight against violence. Mm. Let us fight for differences. Let us fight with differences.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
Isn't that pretty?
I love the title and I love the lines that it comes from. The not like a bee who stings and dies, but like a wasp who stings and stays alive.
Yeah.
I love the sprinkle of gold on a butterfly's wing.
Yeah.
I can't write poetry like that, and I'm not 11.
For real, I'm same.
Like twice that old.
I think, oh, there it is, at Young Authors Greenhouse.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
I love young poets.
Me too. I want to start reading just young poets.
I need to really learn to start like calibrating, you know, like judging the mood of my poems versus yours so that like something like that is closing us out, not something like this. But I really liked this poem. This was in the Atlantic, I think.
No one cares. Got you back, babe.
I absolutely deserve that. And you know what? It's absolutely true. No one cares. But they do care that this is by John Pineda, and this poem is called My Sister Who Died Young Takes Up the Task.
Mm.
A basket of apples brown in our kitchen, their warm scent is the scent of ripening, and my sister, entering the room quietly, takes a seat at the table, takes up the task of peeling slowly away the blemished skins, even half-rotten ones are salvaged carefully. Mm. She makes sure to carve out the mealy flesh. For this, I am grateful. I explain, this elegy would love to save everything. She smiles at me and before long, the empty bowl she uses fills, domed with thin slices she brushes into the mouth of a steaming pot on the stove. Mm. What can I do? I ask, finally. Nothing, she says. Let me finish this one thing alone.
Mm. Ooh. Oh, I love a moment like that. Oh, man.
Isn't that so beautiful?
It's really gorgeous. I feel like you know I can't smell, but I feel like I can smell it. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm right there.
And the sisterly relationships are really, really a big central component of the love songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. Mm. And so it's gotten me thinking a lot about, like, the relationships that people have with their siblings. And speaking of Amy Schneider, everything coming full circle here.
Yeah.
She told that story tonight about her older sister who she never met, who died like in infancy.
Yeah.
Before she was born, that she was like, I still feel like my big sister is like looking out for me somewhere. Those bonds can just be so that powerful, you know, like transcending even the time that we have with people.
Oh, what a beautiful thought to end on too, honey.
Thank you, honey.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. Thank you to Hollis. Holy shit.
Thank you, Hollis.
Hollis, if you're not, are you there, Hollis? It's me, God. No, sorry. Join us next time for something else. How am I doing?
You're doing so good, sweetie.
Thanks, bestie. Okay.
Bye, besties.
Bye.